Our Old Testament reading today comes from Kings, 2 Kings, the 5th chapter, verses 1 through 14. Let us listen for the word of the Lord. Now Naaman was a commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. Now bands of raiders from Aram had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. "By all means go," the king of Aram replied. "I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. The letter that he took to the king of Israel read, "With this letter, I am sending my servant Naaman to you so that you may cure him of leprosy." As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, "Am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he is trying to pick a quarrel with me?" When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him a message. "Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman went to his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a messenger to him to say, "Go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed." But Naaman went away angry and said, "I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the names of the Lord of his God, wave his hand over the spot, and cure me of my leprosy. And not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed?" So he turned and he went off in a rage. Naaman's servants went to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleansed?" So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Our New Testament text today is Luke chapter 10, verses 1 through 11 and 16 through 20. Let us listen for the word of the Lord. "The Lord now chose 70 other disciples and sent them ahead in pairs to all the towns and places he planned to visit. These were his instructions to them. The harvest is great, but the workers are few, so pray to the Lord who is in charge of the harvest. Ask him to send more workers into his field. Now go and remember that I am sending you out as lambs among wolves. Don't take any money with you, nor a traveler's bag, nor an extra pair of sandals, and don't stop to greet anyone on the road. Whenever you enter someone's home, first say, 'May God's peace be on this house.' If those who live there are peaceful, the blessing will stand. If they are not, the blessing will return to you. Don't move around from home to home. Stay in one place, eating and drinking what they provide. Don't hesitate to accept hospitality, because those who work deserve their pay. If you enter a town and it welcomes you, eat whatever is set before you, heal the sick, and tell them, 'The kingdom of God is near you now.' But if a town refuses to welcome you, go into its streets and say, 'We wipe even the dust of your town from our feet to show that we have abandoned you to your fate. And know this, the kingdom of God is near.' I assure you," we're skipping to 16. "Then he said to his disciples, 'Anyone who accepts your message is also accepting me, and anyone who rejects you is rejecting me, and anyone who rejects me is rejecting God who sent me.' When the 70 disciples returned, they joyfully reported to him, 'Lord, even the demons obey us when we use your name.' 'Yes,' he told them, 'I saw Satan fall from heaven like lightning. Look, I have given you authority over all the power of the enemy, and you can walk among snakes and scorpions and crush them. Nothing will injure you. But don't rejoice because evil spirits obey you. Rejoice because your names are registered in heaven.'" This is the word of the Lord. So I grew up with the story of Naaman and Elisha being a story about taking a bath, right? God tells you to go bathe. Of course, I also imagine the river being pretty dirty because, you know, you've probably seen pictures of the Jordan River. It's a lot more like Cache Creek than the Sacramento River. When I went to college in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I don't know if any of you are familiar with the Platte River, which starts out in Colorado and South Dakota and the hills and out there, and then it flows all the way through Nebraska and then joins the Missouri in Nebraska. And by the time it gets to Lincoln, the settlers actually had a saying for the Platte River that, well, I mean, it's a mile wide and a foot deep, and it's too thin to plow and too thick to drink. It's kind of like a milkshake running through there. And we take for granted one of my favorite things to do on a hot day. Like yesterday, I got to go jump up in a high mountain lake, and it was just amazing and clear and cool and beautiful. And on a hot day in Nebraska, you got nothing. There's the Platte River, and you don't really want to jump in because after 600 miles of ag land, oh man, it's got foam on top of it that smells awful. I don't know what it was or is, but it probably could drop it on hostile territories and come out ahead. One Saturday afternoon, me and a bunch of my buddies from college didn't have much else to do, and we're like, let's go to the Platte River. So we started messing around, and then we started daring each other to jump in. And we actually did, and jumped in the Platte River and like swam out to the sandbars in the middle of it. You probably, if you've been there, you've seen them. Came out smelling way worse than we went in. Kind of the exact opposite of this story where Naaman goes in, bathes in the river, and comes out cleansed. We went in the river and came out with six toes. Who knew this was possible? I can imagine what Naaman is feeling like when Elijah tells him what you need to do to be cleansed is to go take a dip in that dirty river. Not unlike, hey, go jump in the Platte. That's not something you say to people you care about or love. And Naaman's a powerful guy. I mean, the story tells us he is the lead general, the commander of the armed forces of the king of Aram. These are the Assyrians. They are a powerful nation. In fact, the context and history of this is that they have kind of overrun and ransacked Israel. This is not a friend. This is an enemy of God's people. In fact, the story, of course, starts out, how does Naaman even hear about coming to Israel? Did you catch this? Like, I mean, we know the story. Elisha tells him to go bathe in the Jordan River seven times. He gets mad because, come on, like, that's a stinky river, and I could have, like, if you would have said, go climb a mountain, go climb Mount Everest, and you'll be cured. All right, let's go do this. This is a hard thing. It's this kind of stupid, somewhat humiliating, dirty thing he wants me to do. And he finally, his servants talk him into trying it, and it works, and it's amazing. He's healed of leprosy, as you know, was an incurable disease that resulted in a somewhat painful death, separation from your loved ones. They didn't want to touch you because they'd catch it. And so this is a disease that separates you from your connection with the human beings around you. It's isolating and dehumanizing in a very profound sense. And this is, of course, a beautiful story about him dipping in the Jordan River seven times and God healing him through this process. But I actually don't think this is a story about taking a bath. I don't even think this is a story about Naaman. I mean, I got grown up saying this is a story about obeying, right? You better do what God says. If he says go dip in the river seven times, go do it. This is not even a story about obedience, I believe. Because did you catch the first few verses? The king of Aram had a great admiration for Naaman, the commander of his army. At this time, Aramean raiders had invaded the land of Israel, and among their captives was a young girl who had been given to Naaman's wife as a servant. One day, the girl said to her mistress, "I wish my master would go to see the prophet in Samaria. He would heal him of his leprosy." What's this a story about? This is a story about a little girl who got ripped away from her home, taken away from her parents, enslaved and hauled off to a foreign land to be a servant. How would you feel if that were you? I would be deeply resentful. Probably the last thing I would want or be willing to do was to bring healing to the person who brought this about. The story was just clear about who was in charge of that victory, right? It was Naaman. But this girl is willing to give of herself, of her resources, of her knowledge and perspective to try and help the person who I might imagine might be her greatest enemy. Of course, I never noticed this till this week, but this story is very much a story of two servants, right? Naaman has this servant girl who isn't even named, but who is willing to speak up, and whose willingness to try and help Naaman results in Naaman being healed. I mean, mind-blowing, by the way. Well, I'll come back to that. The rest of the story that Carol Lou didn't read, the last half of the chapter, is the story of Elisha's servant, Gehazi. And if you don't know the story, I'll just summarize it briefly, but Naaman comes and offers, he gets healed, and so he offers Elisha all of this gold and silver and clothing he has brought with him from the powerful empire to bless this poor provincial prophet to, you know, it's a transaction, right? Transactional, like God provided healing, so I'll pay for it. And Elisha says, nope, not a thing. That's not how God works. Our God is not a transactional God. He just blessed you to heal you because he loves you. Go in peace. Elisha has a servant, Gehazi, the same one who went out and told Naaman in the first place, you need to go bathe in the river seven times, who sees his master do this and can't let it stand, right? Like, he's probably thinking, Elisha, it's tough making ends meet around here. The least you could have done was taken some of the resources from this enemy general and use them for something good. So he waits, and when Elisha is not paying attention, runs down the road chasing Naaman, catches up with him and says, hang up! So right after you left, these two prophets from Ephraim came down, and my master says that he would like 75 pounds of silver and two suits of clothes to give to these young men who just came. And Naaman's like, of course, in fact, have double that. Go on back. Loads him up. Gehazi takes the silver and the clothing and goes back and hides it in his house and then shows up to Elisha, who's like, where you been? Out. And Elisha says, I saw what happened. I saw you taking the clothes, and I saw you using this opportunity for your own gain. And because that happened, Naaman's leprosy is going to be transferred to you. And Gehazi leaves. It says at the end of the story, with his skin white as snow from the leprosy. This is not a story about Naaman. This is a story about serving, about two servants, Naaman's servant and Elisha's servant. It's a story about our purpose and what we're doing here and what it means and what actually matters about how we live our lives. This little girl who the story starts with is kind of the hero here. She is willing to give of herself, to work for the good of someone who was not working for her good. And this brings incredible life and healing. Meanwhile, Elisha's servant, who should be on the side of God and Yahweh and bringing blessing to all, isn't working for the blessing of all. What is he after? Stuff from himself. We can all identify. Working for stuff for myself tends to be one of our natural drives. It's what, again, motivates all advertising you see. Those hundreds of ads you're exposed to every day in magazines, on billboards, on the radio, on TV, are all selling that the point and joy of your life will be found in acquiring more stuff. Just get the right stuff and you will have a wonderful life, right? This is a story very much turning that idea on its head. that the point and purpose and joy we will find in our lives is not found in a quest for more things for ourselves, but found in being willing to use our lives to serve and give to the people around us. I mean, this is a mind-blowing confrontational story, right? That God would be willing to heal the general of the enemy's forces? Really? How? That's a big God. That is a wide willingness to bless. It's one almost beyond my comprehension or beyond my... This is a story, a shocking story about who we choose to share our blessings with, right? That this little girl is willing to share of the incredible strength and blessing of her God with her enemy. I mean, are we willing to care for those beyond our borders? Might be a relevant question today as it was then. The New Testament passage in Luke chapter 10, I think, is actually fitting with this very well, because it is a story about Jesus, who is filled with all power and authority, doing what with it? Jesus now chose 70 other disciples and sent them ahead and told them, "Heal the sick, cast out the demons. All of my power I am giving to you." See, so much of what we get sold about this world is that it is about accruing power, accumulating it, subordinating others to yourself. And these stories are pointing us towards the opposite, that the true meaning of life is not about accruing power for ourselves and dominating others, but rather living to give and to serve and to bless. Jesus sends his disciples out and says, this is kind of the opposite. Don't take money. Don't take a belt. This isn't about you. This is about the people you're going to meet. When I'm sending you out there without stuff, it's because the point of your mission isn't getting stuff. The point of your mission is connecting and caring and loving and serving for the random people you are going to encounter. And when you step into their home and you bring peace and blessing and healing, it is going to change how they are. And tell them that this is the kingdom of God coming now. Do you remember how Luke presents Jesus starting this whole thing? I've got to go back to this, because this is the foundation where Jesus stands up in his hometown synagogue right after he's been baptized and comes out of the wilderness and the temptations. He stands up and reads this and says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, for he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim the captives will be released, that the blind will see, that the oppressed will be set free, and that the time of the Lord's favor has come." The kingdom of God is here. God is taking his power and seeks nothing more than to pour it out through us that we might go and serve those around us. This is such a beautiful invitation. It is upside down of everything else in the way the world is structured. And we, as followers of Jesus, are invited into this work, this harvest. Jesus says, pray that God sends out more, because look out there, there's so many people to go bless. That's not how we tend to look at the world, right? I'm just like, there's so many people on the interstate between here and Sacramento that I couldn't possibly drive in there. Get out of my way. What if we looked at this world as look at the opportunities of people who we can go out and make their days a little bit brighter, for showing them care and compassion, for listening, for bringing a smile and joy and presence, for trying to listen to them and bring healing into the ways they have been wounded, to let them know that they're not alone, that they're cared for, that not only is God with them, but we are too, because of course God is present in us. We're the ones carrying God's power around in pairs, supposed to be going out there to pour that out on the people around us, right? We, like Jesus, are here to serve. That's what Jesus reiterates over and over. He says it 3 different times in Luke. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. The disciples start arguing about who's most important and greatest and who can have the highest authority and most power in the kingdom. And Jesus is like, dudes, knock it off. That's the way it is in the world, but not among you. I came here to serve. And just as I came to serve you, I'm sending you to serve them. This is the whole point. This is the gospel, is that God is with us, loving and serving and caring for us. And we are so loved and so cared for and so taken care of that we can let that love out to everyone around us. We don't have to live in fear that we won't be taken care of, that there aren't enough resources, that we're going to run out. As God came among us to serve us, we are called out to the world to serve those around us. I don't know if you've been following Wimbledon this past week. I sometimes do, I sometimes don't. I'm not a huge tennis fan, but it is really impressive. The game, the athletes are amazing. And this last week, my favorite story out of Wimbledon, I don't know, you probably saw this, was the young girl named Coco Gauff. And she's 15 years old. This is her first, she just turned pro. She's from America. She grew up just, I mean, her heroes were Venus and Serena Williams. The sisters we've seen have just been incredible athletes. Amazing performances. And she grew up watching them, seeing what they could do. She's black too, and they kind of opened her eyes to what an athlete of color could do in a sport that's not traditionally open or welcome to them. And this last week, as it so happened in the first round, Coco Gauff ends up seeded against Venus Williams, who's 39 and won Wimbledon 5 times. And she wins. Like the 15-year-old drops the serve in ways that Venus can't get to. And she's still in there. Since Jennifer Capriati, she's the youngest person to make it to the round of 16. Like, it was this amazing experience to see the young protege defeat the mentor. And Venus was incredibly gracious about it. And just, man, she was doing so well. She was getting her serve in. And you go back and read about it, and you realize just how much work goes into that, right? These aren't people who just, like, happen to be born good at tennis. Since Coco is, that is a horrible myth that offends anyone. Like, I remember back when Ray, what's his name? Shooter, the guard who, until Steph Curry, was the greatest shooter the NBA had ever seen. Anyway, somebody came up to him and was like, man, it's just so amazing to see somebody with so much natural talent. And he just about bit the guy's head off because he was like, no, you don't see that I'm in the gym shooting 3 hours a day. This is not natural talent. This is incredible hard work and effort that have gone into this becoming this way. For these girls, Coco's been training since 7 years old hard. A lot of the time she doesn't want to do it, and in this really messed up situation, her dad's her coach. So dad's like, all right, let's get at it again. Get up. No, dad. But it's work. And there's all these stories about how, I mean, there's been some conflict there between her and her dad, who's pushing her to get out there and improve her serve, to improve how she moves. She's serving the ball at 120 miles an hour. That's what amazes me. When we watch it on tennis on TV, it's like, oh, cool, look what they can do. But when I imagine standing there with a racket trying to track and hit a ball coming at me at 120 miles an hour back to this little tiny square on the other side of the net, there's some respect, right? Wow, that took practice and work and intention and getting up and doing it when she didn't feel like it. If we want to improve our serve, it's going to take some work, some practice, some intention, some doing it when we don't feel like it. I think these stories are calling us towards that, though, being the thing that, of course, brings the most satisfaction in the end. Where we will find our joy and meaning and purpose is very much in investing in how well we care for and serve the people around us. There is no higher calling, because, of course, that is the incarnation of the kingdom of God come among the people around us now. what you were made for. Join me in singing our hymn of response.